Did you know your houseplants can double as pest control? Enter the thrilling world of carnivorous plants. These botanical wonders don't just survive, plant friends, they hunt. From Venus flytraps snapping down on unsuspecting flies to pitcher plants luring bugs into their slippery traps, these plants are more than just green decor. They're nature's own pest management system. Join me today as we explore the bizarre bug-eating world of carnivorous plants, revealing how they work their magic, why they developed a taste for pests, and how you can keep one both as a conversation starter, a houseplant, and an incredible natural exterminator for your indoor jungle. Welcome to the Growing Joy with Plants podcast, where we not only learn how to care for plants successfully, but how to simply and affordably use our plant babies to cultivate more joy in our lives by doing so. I'm Maria, former plant killer turned happy plant lady, author of Growing Joy, The Plant Lover's Guide to Cultivating Happiness, speaker, podcaster, and most importantly, your new best plant friend. On Growing Joy with Plants, you'll find conversations about houseplant care, gardening tutorials, and wellness through the lens of plants.
Plant care is self-care on Growing Joy.
Hello, plant friends. My name's Maria. I'm here to help you care for plants and grow joy. And there's nothing that kind of kills your joy more than a pest infestation that descends on your houseplants. Normally, when we see pests, we go and grab for pest control solutions like neem oil or insecticidal soap. But you might have a sleeper in your houseplant collection or a plant that you need to add to your houseplant collection that can solve the solution for you, and that's carnivorous plants. Carnivorous plants are having a moment right now. I've gotten an influx of requests for more episodes on them, and I understand why. They're gorgeous. They eat fungus gnats that fly around your plants. And they will immediately trigger you to start singing the score of Little Shop of Horrors. So what's not to love, particularly as a theater geek? But I have to say, I've definitely brought a Venus flytrap home before and struggled to keep it alive and kind of watched it withered in front of my face because I didn't know how to care for it. So I called in the big guns today. Kenny, who's the head of education for the International Carnivorous Plant Society, joins me to talk all about beginner's indoor carnivorous plant care. The idea of this episode is if you have a houseplant collection, what carnivorous plant can you add to your houseplant collection to kind of supplement your pest control collection? Kenny is amazing and so knowledgeable. And if you are interested in learning more, the International Carnivorous Plant Society is a treasure trove of information. He references several videos, animated videos that they make that we'll talk about in today's interview. But as I was setting up my own carnivorous plant collection, I rewatched those videos multiple times. They're super helpful. Also, before we dive in, I wanted to give a quick shout out to a local plant shop called Verdant Life near me in Florida. I wanted to make a companion video on YouTube for this podcast episode where I bought a bunch of carnivorous plants, take what Kenny taught me and apply it to adding them to my collection because there are different care requirements for carnivorous plants compared to our other plants, but I was really struggling to find high quality carnivorous plants near me. A lot of them were potted in normal media and there was a very limited selection. So I went online looking for carnivorous plants near me and I found this really cool plant shop called Verdant Life. That's life spelled with a Y. And it's about an hour from me, but they sell nationwide and I was able to put an order on their website and they shipped me this collection of carnivorous plants overnight, and they can ship to you as well if you get inspired after this episode. So thank you so much, Verdant Life. It's a female-owned business. I spoke with her on the phone. She was so awesome. She added an extra plant for me to my purchase, and I just wanted to give her a shout out. Also, I did end up shooting that video where I plant up a bunch of different of the plants that we talked about today. So you can head to my YouTube channel after you're done learning about carnivorous plants to see how I applied this new knowledge that Kenny bestows upon me to my own collection. So we have so much to talk about today. So without further ado, here's Kenny. Carnivorous plant Kenny, so excited to have you here.
Thank you so much, Maria.
I wrote the International Carnivorous Plant Society begging you guys for an expert because I'm blown away by the increase in inquiries about carnivorous plants for houseplant lovers. Carnivorous plants are having a moment right now. And so I figured we needed to make an episode on everything you need to know to care for them. And you are such a fascinating guy, carnivorous plant expert. For those who might not know you, can you introduce yourself and the society and how you became the carnivorous plant guy that you are today?
I've been growing carnivorous plants for about 20 years. And about 5 years ago, I joined the International Carnivorous Plant Society as the education director. And now we've been doing lots of outreach. We created animated videos. We created worksheets and coloring sheets. And one of the things that I'm most proud about is that we have a Carnivores in the Classroom teacher grant for teachers in K-12 all around the world.
Fun!
And the requirement is you have to be a member of the ICPS, which is a very low yearly fee. But the reason behind that is, like you said in the intro, carnivorous plants are sometimes a little difficult. So we don't want these teachers to be overwhelmed with how to grow them. But when you become a member of the International Carnivorous Plant Society, you get access to the last 50 years of newsletters. And that will keep you busy and you will know everything you need to know to keep those carnivorous plants alive. So 5 years ago, I joined the ICPS, and also around 5 to 6 years ago, I quit my day job and I turned my passion into my profession. And now I run a carnivorous plant nursery in Tampa, Florida. And that is a big chunk of my income now. So carnivorous plants are my life.
That's amazing. I'll have to come get some plants from you as, you know, I'm in Tampa. I mean, I'm in Jupiter, not as close to you, but that's very exciting. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people, I think, want to care for carnivorous plants, but a lot of people see that little Venus flytrap at the grocery store in the little, you know, plastic egg, and they think it's cute, or they get it for their kid and they bring it home and that sweet little Venus flytrap dies. You know, I feel like a lot of people accidentally kill carnivorous plants because you think it's a fun idea, but you don't have the knowledge because they really are different than a normal indoor plant for so many different reasons. So let's talk about carnivorous plants. Well, you said, what does your collection look like? Because you said you've been growing them for 20 years. So how did you get into carnivorous plants and what has your collection expanded into?
Probably in middle school, I was also purchasing Venus flytraps from the grocery store and killing them very quickly. And then in high school biology class, we had a guest lecturer who happened to be the hall monitor, the person who yells at people for running in the halls. He came in because he had an entire basement filled with carnivorous plants, and he taught us how to grow them. And I was the only one who showed interest. And the next day in the hall, he gifted me a healthy Venus flytrap and a carnivorous sundew. And I kept those alive for a little bit. And then when I went to college, I explored more flora, and then I've been growing them well ever since. The biggest thing is they need, let's talk about the Venus flytrap first. There's about 1,000 species of plants that have carnivory as an adaptation. So it is a little hard to pigeonhole them all into one group. But for Venus flytraps, they need a lot of light and they need rainwater or distilled water. So when you go to a big box store or you go to the grocery store, I can guarantee that they have not given them rainwater or distilled water. They might have also allowed them to dry out, and they're not going to bounce back from that. Mm-hmm. So they're already 80% dead. And if you go to social media, you will see people rescuing Venus flytraps or attempting to rescue Venus flytraps from those places. And usually there's not a high percentage of survival. So if you want to get a Venus flytrap, you really want to get it from a reputable nursery. And the other thing is, for Venus flytraps, they go dormant from like the fall to the spring. So usually around Halloween to Valentine's Day, they go dormant. So they'll die back completely, and you'll just have this little rhizome in a pot. And what we believe is happening is when people purchase them, let's say it's Halloween, everybody wants like a scary plant, they get a Venus flytrap, not knowing it's naturally going to die back in a week or two. And then they throw away the bulb that will come back in the spring.
Okay, got it. Before we dive into care for all of the different opportunities for carnivorous plants indoors, let's talk about carnivorous plants outdoors, because as houseplant parents, it's important to understand where they live outdoors before you bring them inside. So first off, what is a carnivorous plant?
Yeah, so all houseplants originated from the outdoors, including carnivorous plants.
Exactly.
And in the 80s, a professor from Pennsylvania defined what a carnivorous plant was. So it's only been 40 years where we've had a definition
That's
of what a carnivorous...
kind of wild.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there's like three things that they need to have. One of them is they need to lure and attract their prey. The second one is they have to be able to digest their prey. And that could be their own enzymes, or that could be with beneficial bacteria breaking down the food. And then the third aspect of being a carnivorous plant is that they have to benefit from the digestion of the prey. And that is measured in reproduction and seed quantity. So you can think of lots of plants that have really big thorns that are kind of dangerous, that are toxic, that are poisonous, but we don't call them carnivorous plants.
Because they're not digesting whatever they're thorning. My lime tree isn't digesting me after it pinches me with its thorns. Okay, got it.
Yeah. So let's say hypothetically, like a big grasshopper dies on that lemon or lime tree thorn, and they're just not killing enough food for it to be actually like benefiting the species, you know, not that individual plant, but the species. So that's why we don't consider them carnivorous. And the other really cool thing about carnivorous plants is they've evolved about 8 different times separately in different geologic time span, in different continents. So they're not really closely related to each other. So we kind of group this 1,000 plants that are able to digest their prey into a category. But out of that 1,000 plants, 0 of them use flowers to attract and kill and digest their prey. All of them use modified leaves. So houseplant people love beautiful things. And my favorite type of carnivorous plant are Nepenthes, which are the pitcher plants, the hanging pitcher plants. And a lot of times people will come up to me and say, like, how do I get it to bloom? How can I have more blooms? How do I not kill the blooms? And they do bloom, but nobody grows them for their flowers because they're very tiny. It's a tiny little flower stalk. But what you're looking for is those modified leaves.
Those glorious pitchers that can be purple and lime green and so many. I mean, why do you need a flower on a pitcher plant? They're so beautiful. And then I think one of the reasons why so many people get carnivorous plants indoors wrong is because you really don't understand how they grow outdoors. So where do we usually find, and like you said, there's so many different species, but where do we find carnivorous plants outdoors?
I wrote a book called Florida's Carnivorous Plants, and that is because Florida has the most carnivorous plants out of all of the states in the U.S., and that includes the non-native Venus flytrap, but it also includes the North American pitcher plant, Sarracenia, and then some bladderworts and butterworts, and we also have a carnivorous bromeliad. But if you think about Florida, we do have a subtropical climate, but a lot of these carnivorous plants that are found in Florida that are often the ones that you would be purchasing at a nursery or online, even though we live in a subtropical climate, a lot of those go dormant from November to February. So if you want to have them inside the house, you're going to have to give them artificial light in the winter months to keep them going, or you're going to need to acknowledge that dormancy period and allow them to die back, maybe put the pots with the soil with the rhizomes or the roots into your cold garage or your cold basement, and just like a normal bulb, like a tulip bulb, you just let them rest and then you bring them back. Some people also put the North American pitcher plant Sarracenias and the Venus flytrap bulbs in their fridge, in like their crisper drawer for 3 to 4 months to allow them to rest. And when you do that, they usually do come back bigger and stronger and healthier when you wake them up. So that's kind of one thing to think about. If you want to have a temperate species, it's a little difficult to grow them year round as a houseplant. But my favorite plants are the Nepenthes, the tropical pitcher plants. And I also love the Australian pitcher plant, Cephalotus. They look like little chubby trash cans.
Okay.
And then there's lots of Mexican butterworts, and the scientific name for those are pinguicula. And in Florida, we have 5 species of temperate butterworts. Those are going to die back. But if you get the Mexican butterworts, they can live all throughout the year on a cute little bookshelf next to your house plants, snacking on a couple of your pests. So it depends on the region. And like you were saying, they're all over the world. I've been to Alaska and Iceland, and I've seen wild carnivorous plants in both of those places.
As we are celebrating the longest day of the year, I've got to ask you, plant friend, are your houseplants getting enough light? If they aren't, I highly suggest grabbing a Soltec grow light to ensure your plants are properly lit and happy year-round. We know I've been using them for my happy plants for the last years upon years. Whether you're dealing with limited sunlight or you're just looking to create a cozy atmosphere for your space, Soltec has the perfect grow light solution to help your plants thrive all year long, no matter what your setup looks like. They are designed to deliver the perfect spectrum of light, keeping your plants happy and healthy, and also looking completely like a normal light in your house. Your friends will never know their grow lights unless you want them to know. They have the aspect pendant hanging light. They have the Vita grow bulb. They have the Highland track light system that you might have seen that I recently installed in my office. It's illuminating my green wall, and you can position multiple lights for ultimate flexibility if you have hard to light areas of your house that you want to use it for. And they even have the Grove bar light, which has touch dimming, which is ideal for shelves, walls, and cabinets. Learn more about all of the amazing grow light solutions that they have and visit soltec.com and use the code BLOOM15 for 15% off of your order. That's BLOOM15 for 15% off your order at soltec.com. All right, plant friends. So you should use Kenny's recommendations for caring for carnivorous plants indoors. But when it comes to the house plants that are surrounding your carnivorous plants indoors, you got to use Espoma Organics line of incredible indoor houseplant products, like its indoor houseplant liquid fertilizer. It was the first Espoma product that I ever learned about. I got it at a plant swap that Summer Rain was hosting. She gifted me a bottle of it. It's so simple. It has an easy pour cap. It's a liquid organic fertilizer. All you do is dump it into your watering can, and there you go. It's super gentle, so you can fertilize and add it to your watering can like every time you water or once a month, or you can choose to only fertilize in the growing season, whatever you want. But their indoor liquid houseplant fertilizer makes fertilizing your plants so simple. And then also when it comes to potting your plants, their general potting mix, organic, it's got mycorrhizae in it. It's wonderful. All of my houseplants are potted in it. If you want to get fancy, if you have like aeroids that you want a chunkier mix for, you can add some of their orchid bark and like kind of make your own custom mix. But my houseplants love Espoma Organic. And on this episode, I needed you to know that. If you are interested in learning about Espoma's indoor and outdoor products, because they have indoor stuff, but they're known for all of their outdoor products, their outdoor garden composts and fertilizers, you can go to their website, espoma.com, to find out all about all of their organic indoor and outdoor planty offerings. Or you can go to my Amazon storefront, where I have a curated list of my favorite Espoma products available for you to shop. Thanks so much, Espoma. Wow. Now I'm curious. So I just moved to Florida from New York. It's hot. It's humid. We're doing this interview in August too. So it's like the hottest and most humid Florida is going to get. So I'm surprised to hear that carnivorous plants go dormant. When I think dormant, I think of like deciduous trees that go dormant in the winter because of snow. But Florida, you have like the warmest climate ever. So what is triggering that dormancy? Is it photoperiod?
Yep, it's definitely the photoperiod. And for some carnivorous plants, it also could be the amount of rainfall. For those Mexican butterworts that we're talking about, those are really popular among the houseplant community because they flower multiple times a year, and they eat fruit flies and fungus gnats. So that's why people want to add them to their cabinets and their bookshelves.
I'm so excited to ask you more about butterworts because, yes, the pain point of many houseplant parents is the fungus gnats. But that's very interesting. So it's photoperiod outdoors.
Sorry, Maria, but if the butterworts dry out, they will stop growing carnivorous leaves and they'll start growing succulent type leaves. And then that period of the year out in the wild, they're actually not participating in carnivory.
Interesting. So when a carnivorous plant, and this is probably a silly question, but I don't know it, so I'm going to ask it. Carnivorous plants, the Venus flytrap catches the flies in its trap. The butterworts catch the flies on the leaves, like the sticky substance. Then they're breaking the fly down, or they're breaking the fungus net down. And then are they absorbing those nutrients like a plant, like my house plant that I fertilize with like water with fertilizer in it? And that's where it gets the nutrients. Are the nutrients of that fly that is decomposed what's feeding the plant?
Yeah, so they get energy from the sun. They get energy from photosynthesis, just like...
Via photosynthesis.
Just like a quote, normal plant. We don't want to shame the carnivorous plants because they are a plant.
They're normal too, yeah.
They're getting certain nutrients from the bugs that they eat.
Okay, so it's like the fertilizer, yeah.
So very, very broad brushes. Usually carnivorous plants do not like fertilizer in their soil. Very generally, they grow in areas that have really poor nutrients in the soils. So when you fertilize the soil, their tiny little delicate roots do not appreciate that. And then you might burn them and they die. So some of the carnivorous plants are from Nova Scotia, Iceland, Canada. Some of them are on the top of Tapuis in Venezuela. Some of them are on the top of mountains in the Philippines. Some of them are in desert areas. So they're all in different regions. Some of them are in Brazil. Some sundews grow 6 to 9 feet under the Amazon River, in the river, where sunlight doesn't even reach for most of the year. And yet, these 1,000 or so species have been able to figure out how they can survive in nutrient-poor soils. And the answer to that, evolutionary speaking, for the past 65 million years, was to be able to change some of their enzymes into digestive enzymes. So yes, they are getting their nutrients just like a normal, I'm putting in quotes, normal, typical plant. And those plants also have enzymes. They have lots of different enzymes. And those enzymes for a typical plant usually allow them to fight off fungi, which are mushrooms or, you know, bacteria. And the fungi are made out of chitin. So they have this enzyme called chitinase to fight off fungal attacks. But carnivorous plants use their enzyme chitinase. They've repurposed it to digest other things that are also made out of chitin, like insects. So arthropods are also made out of chitin. So a non-carnivorous plant, they are on the defense. They're trying to deter fungi, whereas carnivorous plants are using chitinase as the offense. They're like actively using those enzymes to break down their food and get nutrients.
Wow, that is so cool. That's wild. Plants are so smart. Like that's the other thing. Plants are so much smarter than we are. So can I ask, is there general care guidelines in terms of like what soil you're putting in, what light they need for all of the species that we're bringing indoors? Or should we go each through each kind of common indoor carnivorous plant?
We can generalize
and then
things.
Kind of dive in after. Okay, so let's do a general carnivorous. You're at the, you know, garden center. There's the carnivorous plant table. You're seeing some pitcher plants. You're seeing some Venus flytraps. You're seeing some sundews, butterworts. What are the things that you need to know in order to not kill the plant?
So like we mentioned earlier, I'm part of the International Carnivorous Plant Society, and we have a meeting every other year. This past year was in Vienna, Austria. And then the year before that was in Japan. And it's scientific names are very important because when you say pitcher plant, there's actually, I think, at least 5 different types of pitcher plants. So
yes,
we have one from California, one from the southeast of the US, one from South America. Then we have 200 from Southeast Asia, and then we have one in Australia. So to generalize it, I think it's good to think about temperate species versus tropical species. So temperate species can include sundews or Drosera, butterworts or pinguicula, bladderworts, which are Utricularia, and then Venus flytraps, which are Dionaea muscipula. So temperate plants that like to die back in the fall, those usually do well in a peat perlite mix, or long fiber sphagnum. So you could do like half peat, half perlite, or you could do 100% long fiber sphagnum, or you could do like 70% long fiber sphagnum and perlite. And that's about it. And most of those temperate plants like to be sitting in water all the time. So for those plants, North American pitcher plants, Venus flytraps, some butterworts, some bladderworts, some sundews, if you could get a little tea plate, a little saucer, an upside down frisbee, put your pot on top of that. So it's always sitting in like an eighth of an inch, a quarter inch of water. And then when the water has evaporated, but before the soil has dried out, add more water. So they need pure water, rainwater, distilled water. They need to be sitting in a little bit of water all the time. And most of them, I know we're bouncing around, but most of them grow in boggy areas. Some of them grow in fens, which are like a swampy, wet soil, but it's a lot of sun because the bog can't support really tall trees because the trees would just top over because the soils are so saturated. So a lot of times people get confused. They're like, oh, I thought a Venus flytrap was from a swamp. Well, they are from like a wetland area. They are from regions where the soil is wet, but it's a full sky. So they're getting sun. They're getting direct sun from morning until night. So if you want to grow them indoors, a sunny window is usually not enough. I will say a sunny window is not enough for temperate plants. So a sunny window is not enough for a Venus flytrap, a North American pitcher plant, and maybe some sundews. So what you'll need to do is you have to give them artificial light. And it's very easy in the year 2024 to find an artificial light that is good enough for a carnivorous plant. You just put it up a couple of inches above the plant. You turn it on for like 12 hours a day, 14 hours a day. You can have a white bulb, you can have a blue-red bulb, and the plant will be so colorful and so beautiful. You will be the envy of Instagram.
I love it. I'm installing a green wall behind me, and I'm putting grow lights. I'm putting a track light system in my ceiling, and I wonder if I could get like an epic pitcher plant for one of the pockets of the green wall. Would that work?
Yeah, so we just talked about temperate plants who... need really full sun. And now we can talk about my favorite. And what you just mentioned are the tropical pitcher plants or the Nepenthes. And those, a lighter soil, so long fiber sphagnum and perlite, and maybe some coconut chips or like orchid bark. So they want something a little lighter. And unlike the other plants, you're going to heavy water them. And then you're going to allow the soil or the substrate to almost dry out completely. And I think this is kind of like an orchid. You want to like soak it. And then as the substrate dries up, the plant is reaching its roots further and further. And the bigger the roots are, the bigger the top part, the part that you're seeing can get. So then, you know, right before it gets all the way dry, you heavy water it again. And again, they do need rainwater or distilled water. If you give Nepenthes city water or well water, the pitchers will stop forming or they'll start getting deformed. So let's say you have a hurricane and you cannot find any distilled water at the grocery store. Well, you can collect the rainwater because it's a hurricane and it's heavily raining.
Yeah, plenty available.
But they will not come back if they dry out completely. So if you need to use city water like one time, do that rather than let them dry out all the way. And then I would give them a couple of rinses through with rainwater, distilled water, once that water's back up. But Nepenthes, they do not require, and they do not like full sun. So those are very good for grow lights indoors. And they also do very well, many of them do very well on a windowsill, like a sunny windowsill. So I think the easiest carnivorous plants for inside are intermediate Nepenthes. So if you can find like a cross or a hybrid of a Nepenthes, those are probably good for a windowsill. If you can find a relatively cheap Nepenthes, they're going to be good for indoors. The reason why some of them are $400, $1,000 is because they're difficult to grow and difficult to reproduce. The ones that cost $20 and they're in an 8-inch hanging basket, the reason why they're so cheap is because they're easy to grow. And that's
okay.
That's true for all houseplants, pretty much, except for some of your variegated ones. But if you're getting started, find a cheap one and keep that one alive. But they don't require as much sun as a Venus flytrap or a North American pitcher plant. So those are a nice, easy one. And then the butterworts. Now, there are cold weather butterworts. There are temperate butterworts or pinguicula. And then there's tropical butterworts or pinguicula. Those are also a great choice to grow inside. Those will flower if you give them a lot of food. So if you like kill a cockroach, a mosquito, you can just place it on top of their leaf and their leaf is sticky and then it will absorb those bugs. And the more they're fed, the happier they are and they will be blooming more often.
Because the Venus flytrap is catching it in its trap. The pitcher plants lure the plant, lure the bugs into the pitchers or the flutes. Then same with the Nepenthes, but the butterworts are the interesting ones because those, I would say they're not as aesthetic because the bugs are just stuck on the leaves, slowly decomposing, right?
That's true for butterworts, and that's also true for the sundews. So you might, or, you know, listeners have probably seen a sundew catch a housefly or an ant, and then they move, you know, this time lapse over 45 minutes, and you see it moving the bug onto more leaves and the little droplets of the sundew are oozing out and they get excited. Well, there's about 220 species of sundews and not all of them move. Just like the pitcher plants, their lids don't open and close. They're always open. They're always ready to eat. So if you want to watch something, you're going to have to get a Venus flytrap. And some butterworts, they'll move the edge of their leaf inward to form like kind of a little upturned plate so the bug doesn't go anywhere and then the enzymes get pumped in and you can kind of get it sloshy. Venus flytraps take 4 to 10 days to digest their food. Pitcher plants overall take about 2 weeks to 2 months to digest their food. And then butterworts and sundews, they're about a week or two. And what will happen is they kind of suck out all the juices and then maybe a little exoskeleton is left and you can get little tweezers and you can just kind of pluck them off when they're done eating.
Hot take, plant friends. There is no one right starter plant. There, I said it. And you know what? While I'm at it, there are also no real plant killers in the world. There are just people who have not figured out their right plants for their lifestyle. This is why I created the free Plant Parent Personality Test, because Plant Friend, I want you to get thriving alongside your houseplants as quickly as possible, so I made this cutie little Plant Parent Personality Quiz that's totally free for you on my website to take the guesswork out of building your plant collection effortlessly and joyfully. After speaking to thousands of members in our community, I realized that there are about 5 key plant parent personalities, each one with their unique set of strengths, weaknesses, and a unique set of plants that thrive under their care. For example, a mindful plant parent, someone who wants to engage with their plants daily, use them in their morning routines. If someone gifted that plant parent a succulent and they watered it every day, that succulent would die immediately. However, that drought-resistant succulent is a perfect match for a low-key plant parent, which is someone who travels, has kids, is busy, doesn't have time to engage with their plants every day. They're looking to engage with their plants more like once a week or once every couple of weeks. In addition, obviously, to understanding your light and basic plant care that we provide on this podcast, Happy Plant Parenthood is all about discovering your personality and then picking the right houseplants to go with it. It's that simple. No more stressing over your collection. So what plant parent personality type are you, plant friend? All you got to do to find out is take my free quiz on my website and let me know. You can access it at growingjoywithmaria.com/personality. After taking the test, you'll get an email with a list of plants, podcast episodes, and planty projects that I think would light you specifically up like a full spectrum grow light. So once again, that's growingjoywithmaria.com/personality for your free plant parent personality test results. Take, plant friends, there is no one right starter plant. There, I said it. And you know what? While I'm at it, there are also no real plant killers in the world. There are just people who have not figured out their right plants for their lifestyle. This is why I created the free Plant Parent Personality Test, because Plant Friend, I want you to get thriving alongside your houseplants as quickly as possible. So I made this cutie little Plant Parent Personality Quiz that's totally free for you on my website to take the guesswork out of building your plant collection effortlessly and joyfully. After speaking to thousands of members in our community, I realized that there are about 5 key plant parent personalities, each one with their unique set of strengths, weaknesses, and a unique set of plants that thrive under their care. For example, a mindful plant parent, someone who wants to engage with their plants daily, use them in their morning routines. If someone gifted that plant parent a succulent and they watered it every day, that succulent would die immediately. However, that drought-resistant succulent is a perfect match for a low-key plant parent, which is someone who travels, has kids, is busy, doesn't have time to engage with their plants every day. They're looking to engage with their plants more like once a week or once every couple of weeks. In addition, obviously, to understanding your light and basic plant care that we provide on this podcast, Happy Plant Parenthood is all about discovering your personality and then picking the right houseplants to go with it. It's that simple. No more stressing over your collection. So what plant parent personality type are you, plant friend? All you got to do to find out is take my free quiz on my website and let me know. You can access it at growingjoywithmaria.com/personality. After taking the test, you'll get an email with a list of plants, podcast episodes, and planty projects that I think would light you specifically up like a full spectrum grow light. So once again, that's growingjoywithmaria.com/personality for your free plant parent personality test results.
So I think a lot of people, particularly with the Venus flytrap, think that they need to feed the plant. And you've heard of people like feeding a Venus flytrap like raw meat or like, you know, something weird. Do you have to intentionally feed these plants or do you let them do their thing and trust that a fly will fall on them or in them?
All right, Maria, we are going all over the place because we never said how my personal collection has expanded in the past 20 years. So I started with one one Venus flytrap, one sundew, and now in my personal collection, I only have, let's say, 50, 60 plants. But because I'm a nursery, I always have about 4,000 carnivorous plants in stock all the time. And I do fertilize them, and that's kind of for the advanced version of this podcast, but I do not hand feed any of the plants. And they all do great. So for a Venus flytrap, if you go to YouTube and you type in International Carnivorous Plant Society, you will see that we have 5 animated videos, which I wrote. And one of them is about how to hand feed a Venus flytrap. And yes, in the 70s and the 80s, people were saying, you can feed a Venus flytrap raw hamburger. You can feed it bologna. But guess right. what? All of those plants died. So that don't do that.
Yeah, don't do that. I'm going to go ahead and assume that's not the... We're busting myths on this episode. Please don't give your Venus flytrap hamburger.
I mentioned earlier that carnivorous plants have that enzyme chitinase, which helps break down things that have chitin, which arthropods do. But they also have some other enzymes like amylase and protease and a whole bunch of other enzymes that we have and other organisms have. But what a Venus flytrap really wants to eat are spiders or crawling insects like beetles. So if you can give them that, that's good. But the way that the Venus flytrap works is that one plant will have maybe 7 to 15 traps on it. And each trap can only digest about 3 times. So if you stick your finger in there, it will close. And then after about 40 minutes to an hour, it will open up again. And then you could stick your finger in it again, and then it will close a little bit slower, and then it'll open up again. And it could do that maybe 10 times, 20 times. But if there's food inside it, it can only do that 3 times, and then that leaf will turn brown, and then it will turn black, and it will die. So in the video, we mention that you can feed it if you find a little... All right, they want to eat something that is 1/3 to 2/3 the size of the trap. So you have to look at the trap, and if you find something that's like half the size of the trap, that's pretty good. The Guinness Book of World Records for a Venus flytrap in 2022 was like 2.25 inches.
Mm-hmm.
So in Florida, I'm at a plant sale every weekend from September through May. So, you know, like 36 weeks a year, I'm at a plant sale. And I have probably 100 people a year tell me, oh, your Venus flytraps are a lot smaller than I thought they were going to be. When I was a kid, I saw a Venus flytrap whose mouth was 1 foot long or 2 feet wide. And I have to tell them, no, you did not. That was a movie. And you have...
That was a movie.
you have conflated the Little Shop of Horrors with
right.
an actual Venus flytrap. All right. So you want to find something that's half the size of the trap, roughly. And if you can't find a live bug, in the video, we mentioned that you can go to the pet store and you can buy dead mealworms or you can buy dead bloodworms, like fish food. And then you make a little meatball and then you stick it in the trap. And let's say in the 70s and 80s, people were saying, okay, you can do that. And then you walk away. But what happens is the plants cannot think, but they can count. So on the inside of their traps, in each trap, they have 2 to 4 trigger hairs. And if one of the trigger hairs gets touched, nothing happens. But if one of the trigger hairs or a second trigger hair gets touched within 20 seconds, then a calcium action potential occurs where water gets pumped from the inside of the trap to the outside. And because there's more water on the outside of the lobe, it's heavier. And because it's heavier, it snaps shut. So that's how they grab their food. But then just in the past 2 to 3 years, I believe it was the Germans, they figured this out. The trigger hair has to be touched 4 to 6 more times once the lobes are closed in order for the Venus flytrap to go through its full digestion phase, which takes 4 to 10 days. So if you put a dead meatball in there, if you put a dead insect in there.
And it's not struggling.
It's going to close, but then after an hour, it's going to open up and it will not have eaten. So in the video, we recommend, I would say I have 600 to 800 Venus flytraps all the time, and each of them have 10 mouths. So that's a lot of mouths to feed. That is why I do not do this. So what you have to do is you put a little meatball in there, you put a dead insect in there, it closes, and then for about 45 minutes, every like 5 to 10 minutes for 45 minutes, you have to keep going back to that leaf and you have to kind of gently massage the outer lobe so those trigger hairs get touched.
You have to tickle it.
Yeah, you have to tickle. Now, remember, it's going to be close. So you're just going to be like massaging the outside. So the inside trigger hairs are being triggered. And then you don't do anything for 4 to 10 days. And then after 4 to 10 days, it will open up and it will have sucked out all the juices that it needs to if it was a meatball. Or it will digest that insect. Now, in order for a Venus flytrap to digest, or in order for most carnivorous plants to digest, they need to have a lot of energy. And they get their energy from the sun. So if you have it in a dark bedroom, or you can just imagine like having a little Venus flytrap in the corner of like a kid's bedroom
mm-hmm.
where there's no sun, no grow lights,
mm-hmm.
then you don't have enough energy to digest it. So while your kid might love running around and grabbing bugs and sticking them in their little mouths, it's not going to have enough energy. And you can kind of test to see if it has enough energy by putting a toothpick, you know, like rubbing a toothpick on the inside of one of the mouths. If it snaps shuts, like 1/10 of a second, like really fast, then it's ready to eat. If it slowly closes, it's going to need a lot more sun, or you're going to need to just give it more hours of the grow light, but it's not going to be able to digest. And the other thing for all 1,000 carnivorous plants is they do not necessarily need to eat bugs to live. Most of them only need like one bug every 6 to 8 months and they'll get by. Because a lot of people say, well, I don't have any bugs in my house. So how is this plant going to eat? But they probably do have bugs.
Yes, you do. Yeah. Yes, you do have bugs. Right. You have a rogue mosquito flying around at some point. Yeah, totally.
But you can feed them those fish food items like I mentioned, or you could just kill a bug. Or if you find a dead bug, you could pop it in their mouth, depending on what type of plant. And they'll be happy. The more you feed them, the bigger they grow. Usually the more colorful they get.
Okay.
So you do want to keep them happy. And those aspects are clean water, a lot of light, and the occasional feeding.
So once every 2 months.
I would say you wouldn't want to do it more than once a week. I think 2 times a month is a good is a good pattern.
Because I'm going to assume whatever plant I bring into my house, it with all my other houseplants too. Like if you're a houseplant parent bringing a Venus fly, like a carnivorous plant into your house, like 100% that plant is going to have a bug or two. So if I am not in a sterile house that has no bugs and I, you know, fully admit that I do, should I just be making sure that the plant has a closed trap or a pitcher that has a bug in it every couple weeks? And if it doesn't, then I supplement it. And if it does, can you overfeed a carnivorous plant if you're giving it the light that it needs?
You can't really overfeed it if you're giving it insects or mealworms or bloodworms, but you certainly can over-fertilize it or feed it if you're giving it an artificial, like seaweed fertilizer or like a leaf.
Okay, so if I got the bloodworms from the store and my carnivorous plant, my pitcher plant got 4 flies this month and I decided to give it 4 flies or 4 bloodworms, like I don't have to be worried about that. It's just that I don't want to be fertilizing it with an artificial fertilizer as well, which it sounds like you're not really recommending.
Yeah, the word I was looking for is foliar fertilizer.
So, foliar fertilizer, yeah.
Yeah, so for the Nepenthes, the tropical pitcher plants, those start off like cute little 3-inch hanging baskets, but then they turn into 6 to 10 foot long vines. Those do react, as well as some other carnivorous plants, they do react well with a foliar fertilizer. And our recommendation is usually you're going to use like an orchid fertilizer or a seaweed-based fertilizer, but you're going to read the direction, but then you're going to dilute it to 1/4 of what they recommend. So just like a light fertilizer once a week, once every other week. And if you forget to fertilize it,
you're probably fine.
Well, don't save up for like 1 month and then give it a lot of fertilizer.
Like, right, instead of a fourth. Okay, got it. So just to kind of zoom out for a minute, I'm hearing there's a lot of different species of carnivorous plants. We kind of break them down into the temperate versus the tropical, and then their needs are based off of different things. We've got the temperate, which are the ones that it feels like those are the ones that we see in the grocery store, the Venus flytrap, the traditional pitcher, and those are the ones that need the pot of water at the bottom. Like you're planting the plant in the perlite and moss, but then you're putting that planter in a pot of water so that you kind of recreate that kind of swampy, boggy situation. And those need a lot of light. Then on the other side, we've got the tropical plants that don't need that boggy situation. So you're watering them, you're letting them dry out a little bit. Those are going to be the
Nepenthes.
The Nepenthes and the butterworts. And it feels like those are a little easier to care for than, like, I feel like when everyone thinks of carnivorous plants, everybody thinks of the Venus flytrap, but it sounds like that's not the ideal houseplant. Like, for a houseplant person like me, I've got houseplants. I want carnivorous plants as pest control. I want to put a little carnivorous plant in all, like, in and around all of my other plants to deal with fungus gnats, to deal with thrips, to deal with mosquitoes. I'm allergic to mosquitoes. What are, in your opinion, the best houseplant friendly carnivorous plants? Not for the like carnivorous plant person like you that has 60 carnivorous plants, but for someone who wants to like dabble in the art of carnivorous plantery.
So there's about 6 or 7 different categories that we can artificially put carnivorous plants into, and that's how they eat. So the reason why the Venus flytrap is so famous and everybody wants one is because you can see it move. You can see it reacting.
It's so fun. It's so fun. Yeah.
But I would agree, they're not really the easiest to start off with. If you live in most of North America, it would be recommended that you grow them outside. And if you go to that video that I was mentioning, I'll also mention that you want to just feed one leaf. And then after 4 to 10 days after it's digested, feed that leaf again. And then feed it the third time. And then that leaf's going to die. But during those 30 days, the whole plant is getting a lot of nutrients, a lot of energy, and it's getting bigger. And then you're getting new leaves that you can feed. But if you want something that moves and you want something that is easy, and you want something that's attractive, the easiest carnivorous plant is Drosera capensis, or the Cape sundew. It is from It's from South Africa. They get maybe the size of a softball, so they kind of get big. They come in, the typical ones, like the wild type ones you're going to see, have a green leaf with red dew on them. But because people, just like houseplant people, carnivorous plant people, love breeding and
yes, of course,
experimenting with. So somebody has created, actually one of our board members has created one called a cultivar, a cultivated variety called Hercules. So it has like short, chubby leaves and it gets really
cute.
Tall. Then we have one that's all green. So the dew is green. Then we have one that has a red leaf and red dew, but they're all sundew. They're all Drosera capensis. They're all Cape sundews. They're easy because they do not go dormant. So they grow year round and they're very attractive. They get big. The dew is visible. And if you find a dead bug and you put it on a leaf, you can watch the leaf move over the course of 45 minutes. And my former job was a middle school science and agriculture teacher. So this made a great classroom pet because classes are 50 minutes long and you're like, all right,
let's all watch this leaf. Yeah.
Period two. On Mondays, you get to feed one leaf of the sundew. Let's check in on it at the end of the class, right? And so not all plants, most carnivorous plants are generalist, but sundews and butterworts do a better job eating fruit flies and fungus gnats than pitcher plants and Venus flytraps, because a Venus flytrap wants to eat something half the size. And at the end of their lobes, they have these cilia, these like long protrusions. If a tiny thing goes in there, they first close, and then that trigger hair has to be touched 4 to 7 more times before it starts that sealing phase and the digestion phase. And that is because evolutionarily, if they catch something really small, they don't want to have their mouth closed for 10 days on a tiny little thing. They want to eat something big. So usually a Venus flytrap will actually let the fruit flies and the fungus gnats go because it's not worth their time.
Picky eater. Yeah. And that's why the butterworts and the Cape sundews, where the fungus gnats are literally just getting stuck on the sticky substance.
It's like fly paper. Exactly.
It's fly paper. It's a way cuter fly paper. I'm sold.
Yeah. So there's the active traps. And then one of the categories is literally called fly paper traps. And that's what we're talking about.
And then also in terms of like my watering practice with my houseplants, I would be watering that kind of the same way I'm watering my houseplants, maybe a little more frequently to make sure that it doesn't dry out. But I'm top watering the soil. I don't have to worry about some sort of saucer of water that I'm going to let dry out accidentally and forget about. Like I'm watering it when I water my houseplants.
For a lot of the Mexican butterworts and for the sundew that we're talking about, Drosera capensis, you do want to have a saucer underneath them. And
oh, you do? Filled with water?
Like an eighth of an inch or a quarter inch.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So you don't you cannot let them dry out. And I was glad you mentioned that. So what I usually recommend is just keep filling the saucer. You know, every time the saucer's empty, you can just add it. But that was a good point. For the butterworts, some people are a little put off by the amount of dead bodies they will find on the sundew or the butterwort as the fruit flies or the fungus gnats are accumulating. And that is when you can overhead water them, get all the leaves wet, and it kind of just rinses off the exoskeletons. Because that, of course, is how what happens in the wild. It rains.
Oh, and it rinses them off. And right, rain, durr. And then am I planting these up in a plastic pot, in a terracotta pot? Like what's the recommended type of pot that you put them in?
I think there's only one carnivorous plant out of 1,000 that can handle a terracotta pot. So all of them need to be in a plastic pot or a glazed ceramic pot. So some a lot of ceramic pots don't have the glaze on the inside. And evolutionarily speaking, they have grown in nutrient-poor soils in very clean environments. And if you give them a terracotta pot, those salts and minerals from that clay will leach into the soil. And that will actually kill the carnivorous plants.
Oh, I'm so happy I asked that. I didn't realize that was going to be the answer. We're coming close to our time. I have so many more questions for you. What are like the top egregious errors that you see people making? Help us. Help us, Kenny. What are the things that, you know, what are the biggest mistakes I could make when dipping my toe in carnivorous plants?
Probably the biggest thing is water. But then the second biggest thing is lighting. So they do require a lot of lighting for carnivorous plants. I would not worry about feeding them or even, I wouldn't even worry about them catching food for like the first like 3 to 6 months. Just let them be. If you can keep them alive with the clean water and the lighting for 3 to 6 months, then you're good to go.
Okay. Clean water and lighting. Don't put your carnivorous plants in a dark spot. They need the sunny, even the sundews and the butterworts. What's the lowest light for low light people? What's like the lowest light tolerant carnivorous plant?
The Cape sundew can handle it, but if sundews are not dewy, if they're not producing that mucilaginous substance, that means they need more light. So usually they don't need more water. They usually need more light.
Oh, yeah. So like, what are other common troubleshooting? So you mentioned like the pitcher plants, pitchers shriveling up and turning black, or the Venus flytraps turning black. Is that that's a water issue, right? You said?
It's natural for the flytraps for their lobes to turn black after they've eaten 3 times. But if they're not given enough light, they'll also turn black. Okay. The biggest faux pas, I think, is moving your plants too frequently. A lot of times people will say, I have a bunch of these drain flies in my kitchen. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to move the sundew inside every day during the day, but then I'm going to put it outside so it can get enough sun. Well, plants are not known for their migratory habits. They do not like to be moved around all the time. We mentioned this very briefly, but we live in hot and humid Florida. Some of the pitcher plants are from cloud forests, where it's really humid. Some of them are from actual rainforests. Almost all plants, including normal house plants, are from more tropical, humid environments compared to our homes. But almost all of the plants will adapt fine, and that's including the carnivorous plants. But they cannot adapt if you're moving them inside and outside, you know, every day, from super high humidity to low humidity to high light to low light. So find a spot and let them sit there for a good 10 days to let them adjust. So the 5 videos are, one is, and they're all animated videos and they're all 5 minutes and they're all kid friendly. One of them is how to grow carnivorous plants indoors. Another one is how to grow carnivorous plants outdoors. Another one is how to acclimate your new carnivorous plant, because it might be difficult to find carnivorous plants in a quote normal nursery. So what we think is a lot of people are ordering carnivorous plants online, and some of those people ship bare root. So you're going to need to know how to acclimate your plant. And then one of the videos is how to feed a Venus flytrap. And there's probably another video, but I forget which one it is. So go to International Carnivorous Plant Society.
Yeah, we'll link them in the show notes. I mean, go to International Carnivorous Plant Society, but we'll link everything. If you send me links, we'll link everything in the show notes to make sure, because I bet people are going to be eating up that acclimating, because I think people do. Now, do you sell online? If people wanted to buy carnivorous plants, could they buy them from you?
Yes, absolutely. I ship every Monday.
Amazing.
Another thing about the International Carnivorous Plant Society's YouTube pages, we only have those couple of animated videos, but the first Wednesday of May every year is World Carnivorous Plant Day. And that is where we get over 24 videos from growers and hobbyists and scientists from all over the world. And they make videos and we post them there. So you can see like 3 or 4 years of archives of World Carnivorous Plant Day. But also the society, I host 1 to 2 webinars a month. So if you want to watch a 1-hour webinar on pest and disease control for carnivorous plants and my guest for that episode was Damon Collinsworth of California Carnivores,
who's been on the podcast. Yeah.
You can watch an entire hour of just carnivorous plant specific.
Oh my God. You and Damon together must be incredible. That must be the most amazing webinar ever.
And then we also have webinars on how to breed plants, how to propagate plants, how to grow them. So you could go down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, I was on your website and you really, I mean, if we have carnivorous plant listeners who are not part of the society, what are you doing with your life? You must get on it. Cause yeah, it's such an active, I was kind of surprised when I was on your website poking around being like, wow, this is so much information. It's so active. You're actively doing all these webinars so much. So where can people find the society? Where can people buy your book? And where can people order from you and follow you, Kenny, as well?
So for the International Carnivorous Plant Society, we are on Instagram and Facebook. And then the website is carnivorousplants.org. And that's the public website. So that means everyone can go there and you can get growing guides. And I mentioned that Carnivores in the Classroom grant. In order for teachers to receive $150 worth of free carnivorous plants shipped directly to their classroom, they have to make a lesson about carnivorous plants. And this is the second or third year. We have about 50 lessons, and they're separated by elementary, middle, and high school that everyone can download for free right now.
Oh my gosh, that's so cool.
And everything is in PowerPoint or Word. So the idea is teachers are going to download it, and they know their students the best. They're going to add their name to the first slide, and then they're going to delete a slide because the kids already know about that adaptation. Then they're going to add this because they need to step it up for their kids, right? So we want people to be utilizing these resources and adding to them, subtracting from them. And also for this year, we partnered with a person who prints 3D models of things. And based off of what we sent them, they made 5 3D printed models of carnivorous plants, like of each of different categories. So there's a Venus flytrap, there's a Nepenthes, there's a Australian pitcher plant. And if you have a 3D printer, or if your kids go to a school that has a 3D printer, you can get those 3D printing instructions for free, and you can just print them yourself. So that's for the International Carnivorous Plant Society. And my name is Kenny Coogan. My website is kennycoogan.com. And my business, my nursery, my Florida State Certified Nursery, is called Critter Companions by Kenny Coogan. And I travel all over Central Florida to all the huge plant shows. So you can see me in person if you come to Florida, or I do ship every Monday.
Yeah, maybe I'll have to order a plant or two for my green wall from you. I'm getting very excited about this. I love it. Well, thank you so much, Kenny. And I'm so excited to see how this episode goes, because like I said, we've had tons of inquiries about carnivorous plants. I think they're having a moment, and I think they're a freaking no-brainer for houseplant parents to add to their collection. So who knows, maybe we'll have you on again in 2025 to nerd out about carnivorous plants even more.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Maria.
Thank you so much, Kenny. Once again, go check out the International Carnivorous Plant Society. He is so knowledgeable. There are so many amazing carnivorous plant experts that offer so much education. Their YouTube is amazing. Like I said, I went back and watched that animated video series that Kenny was talking about multiple times before I planted up my carnivorous plants. If you want to see my carnivorous plant journey, you're welcome to head over to my YouTube. We'll make sure that we put the links to both the International Carnivorous Plant Society's animated videos and then my YouTube video where I plant my carnivorous plants up. They're doing great. They're in my green wall. I'm looking at them right now. My Venus flytrap has yet to die on me. I'm watering with my distilled water. I have them in the perfect mix that Kenny had recommended. So we're going great. It's so fun to grow something new. I am kind of a nerd, and I keep like taking the pot off the wall and seeing if there are any bugs in the traps. I haven't seen any bugs yet. So what I think I'm going to do, I did buy the bloodworms, and I'm going to make the little meatballs Kenny talks about, and I'm going to feed them to the plants soon. And it's going to be really fun and weird. I'm so excited. So anyway, thank you to Kenny. Thank you to International Carnivorous Plant Society. Thank you again to Verdant Life. They shipped plants in such beautiful condition, and the plants are doing so well, and they came in the right mix. They came in sphagnum moss, whereas all of my local places that I was shopping, like, they were in soil. And as Kenny talked about, that's not a good situation. So anyway, this was such a fun episode. Let me know if you want more carnivorous plant episodes. Like, let me know what you want to hear about. Like, what would a 2.0 episode look like for you? Like, what do you want to learn more about? Let me know. And I hope this episode, along with all of our free weekly episodes and YouTube videos, help you continue to keep growing joy. Plant friend, thank you for tuning in today. It means so much to me that I get to be part of your planty journey.
If you like what you heard, make sure you're subscribed to the show so you never miss an episode. We have so many incredible interviews and solo episodes on incredible houseplant and gardening topics that you will not want to miss this year. And while you're over there in the podcast player subscribing, why don't you click over to the review section of Growing Joy with Plants and leave us a review? Reviews are tremendously helpful for the growth of the podcast, so thanks in advance. If you're looking for more opportunities to grow as a plant parent with Growing Joy content, we've got so many options for you. First, I highly recommend you taking the Plant Parent Personality Test. It's free. It's super fun. It takes 3 minutes to complete. At the end of the test, you're going to get your plant parent personality profile and a curated list of plants, projects, and podcast episodes that are right up your alley, tailored just for you and your lifestyle, inspired by your results. The links are in the show notes. If you're looking to uplevel your plant parent game, I have so many free downloads on my website that I think could help you, like the Understanding Natural Light download or 9 different ways to green up your office space. If you'd like to support the show monetarily and help me bring the show to as many people as possible for free, you can head to our Patreon link in the show notes to learn more about our offerings. And finally, I invite you to come hang out with me and continue the planty conversation on social media, on Instagram and TikTok. I'm Growing Joy with Maria. My DMs are always open if you have requests for topics or ideas for the show. Thank you again for listening. It is truly my honor and delight to help you keep blooming and keep growing joy. Hot take, plant friends. There is no one right starter plant. There, I said it. And you know what? While I'm at it, there are also no real plant killers in the world. There are just people who have not figured out their right plants for their lifestyle. This is why I created the free Plant Parent Personality Test, because plant friend, I want you to get thriving alongside your houseplants as quickly as possible. So I made this cutie little plant parent personality quiz that's totally free for you on my website to take the guesswork out of building your plant collection effortlessly and joyfully. After speaking to thousands of members in our community, I realized that there are about 5 key plant parent personalities, each one with their unique set of strengths, weaknesses, and a unique set of plants that thrive under their care. For example, a mindful plant parent, someone who wants to engage with their plants daily, use them in their morning routines. If someone gifted that plant parent a succulent and they watered it every day, that succulent would die immediately. However, that drought-resistant succulent is a perfect match for a low-key plant parent, which is someone who travels, has kids, is busy, doesn't have time to engage with their plants every day. They're looking to engage with their plants more like once a week or once every couple of weeks. In addition, obviously, to understanding your light and basic plant care that we provide on this podcast, Happy Plant Parenthood is all about discovering your personality and then picking the right houseplants to go with it. It's that simple. No more stressing over your collection. So what plant parent personality type are you, plant friend? All you got to do to find out is take my free quiz on my website and let me know. You can access it at growingjoywithmaria.com/personality. After taking the test, you'll get an email with a list of plants, podcast episodes, and planty projects that I think would light you specifically up like a full spectrum grow light. So once again, that's growingjoywithmaria.com/personality for your free plant parent personality test results.